Today, more bail-in shocks. The banks privately admit that bail-in laws are unclear and murky. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, John Adams and I are going to look further into the whole question of deposit bail-in. John, we've been doing quite a lot here, haven't we?
We have indeed, sir.
So I guess a good place to start this one is to just run quickly through where we got to, right? Which essentially was that earlier in the year, there was some legislation that was passed. The legislation is unclear. Some people think that deposit bail-in is feasible and possible.
Yes.
And it's either because it's vague deliberately or vague by mistake.
Yeah.
And yet we've had a torrent, if you like, of people saying, no, there's nothing to see here. Deposit bail-in isn't even on the cards. Or indeed, there are other types of bail-in, but not deposit bail-in, right?
Yes.
And so we did a couple of posts earlier on. We'll put the links below to those. But we've had a whole host of people now send us stuff through the channel and privately. A lot of that correspondence we won't disclose in the public forum. But nevertheless, the thematics are quite interesting.
Indeed.
And I've also been doing some further research and have had a number of conversations with senior people in a number of the financial institutions in Australia as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to talk about some of those.
Yes.
And then perhaps stand back and think about, well, what does this actually tell us?
Indeed.
Okay. So let me sort of start then with the conversation with what I've been up to.
Right? Okay.
So I've had more than 60 pieces of correspondence now with individuals across Australia who have in some way or another engaged either their bank or the political people, which could be their members of parliament or senior members of the cabinet or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in each case, it's been through telephone or by email, and where it's been by email and where they've got responses, they've sent those responses back to me.
Yep.
Right? And essentially, there's been a number of politicians who said there's no bail-in at all. Deposits are not ever going to be bailed in.
Yes.
Right? Definitively.
Yes.
Right?
And we have one statement that we will read shortly about that.
Absolutely. So there is on one side of the fence, as it were, politicians who are saying there is no chance of deposit bail-in.
That's correct.
But a number of other responses that I've had were much less clear than that, right? So effectively, where individuals wrote to their bank, the banks have tended to come back and said, go and talk to APRA,
mm-hmm.
right? Or put a submission into the Royal Commission or whatever, right?
Yep.
But they were very unclear about precisely what the state of play was.
Yes.
Yep. Now, as a result of that, I then followed up and spoke to a number of banks and asked some quite hard questions.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I was quite surprised because a number of the institutions that I connected with were actually quite open about the situation. But I think we can say that there are two camps. Right? There are some banks and some majors and some of the smaller banks who basically said, don't think deposit bail-in is on the table at all. Might be other sorts, but not deposit bail-in. But refer to APRA. And essentially, APRA has been very clear about it. So whatever you might think, it's actually all about APRA, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line is, don't think there's an issue.
Okay.
Other banks, though, have said, well, we haven't had that many people ask us about this, right? But privately, we agree that it's not clear.
Yeah.
Right? So we don't actually know what the real intent of APRA's position is and what the legislation was, whether in fact bail-in was conceived to be something which could be linked to deposits or not, right? And they are privately talking with APRA and trying to cajole APRA to be clearer about what the situation is.
Yes.
Right?
Now, so at this point, the question for me is, so you said when referring to the banks, they think. Now, what I am wanting to get clarity from you is, one is about intent versus the state of the law. So obviously what we've done in the three-part series is we basically went to certain clauses and said it was unclear. Advisor within a political party in Parliament said that we needed to refer to other clauses. And then in part two, we referred to those other clauses and showed how that an instrument needs to have terms that are explicit saying that this instrument can be bailed in. And we showed that with the terms and conditions of the deposit accounts, that the banks can change those terms and conditions basically whenever the case may be. So I guess the question for you, Martin, is the banks unclear about the state of the law or about APRA's intent? Or both?
It's APRA's intent more than the state of the law.
So, okay.
All of the people that I spoke with agreed that in their terms and conditions, there is a get out of jail clause. In other words, if the regulators say jump, then they have the ability to jump.
Okay. Right? So on that point, so you got confirmation, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but effectively confirmation that legally it is on the it is live.
Correct. So the terms and conditions that everybody signs,
yes,
includes this sort of catch-all clause, which basically says if the regulators or some other agency, you know, insist on doing something, then they have the ability to be able to change the terms and conditions. And that's a generic clause. It isn't specifically relating to deposit bail-in. It's a generic clause.
That's right.
Pretty much in all banking products.
Yes.
So it's there as a catch-all.
Yes.
Right? And that exists.
Yep.
And none of the banks that I spoke with, and I spoke with a number, tried in any way to deny that that was the state of the law.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
So I think that part of it's definitive and clear.
Yes.
There is a gaping hole.
There is a gaping hole.
Right.
Yeah.
But the question then is, what's APRA's intent?
Yes.
Or what's the government's intent?
Uh-huh.
And is there a gap between the two? I'm not sure. Right?
Yeah.
That's where there's lack of clarity. Because some of the banks were saying, actually, there's no real intent to bail in deposits that we can see. Refer to APRA's statements, and they refer to Wayne Byer's statement that we've played a couple of times previously about depositors are safe. APRA is there to protect depositors. QED, there's no deposit bail-in.
Yeah, well, yeah. So on that point, the APRA chairman has said depositors are to be protected, not deposits.
Correct. And all of the banks that I spoke with got themselves in a bit of a knot between depositors and deposits.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So I think that you know, that's not angels on a head of a pin. I think there's a difference.
Yep.
Right? Because you could actually argue you can protect depositors by bailing deposits.
Precisely.
Right?
Precisely.
But nevertheless, some banks are quite clear and said to me, no, we don't think there's an intention to bail in deposits to protect depositors.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
But the others, you know, and slightly more than 50% of the people that I spoke with were actually much less clear than that.
Yep.
They said, yeah, there is confusion between deposits and depositors. We agree. And there is confusion about what APRA's intent was.
Yes.
You know, and basically I asked the question, well, do you think it's a cock-up or do you think it's a conspiracy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to a person, they all said, we think it's a cock-up.
Right.
So the official position, if you like, or the unofficial official position, because, you know, none of them want to be quoted on camera as saying this, and none of them will allow me to say who it was who said this, which is fine. But the official position, as far as I can see it, is that they do believe that there's a lack of clarity.
Right.
And therefore, they are actually applying some pressure behind the scenes to try and get APRA to make it clearer, because they do believe that there is confusion. And, of course, if you can compare and contrast the Australian situation with the New Zealand situation, where everybody agrees that deposit bail-in is absolutely there in New Zealand, it sort of brings into sharp contrast the gap between the clarity in New Zealand and where we are.
Yes. Okay. So just to surmise, we have effective confirmation that legally bail-in is possible because the banks admit that it can change their terms and conditions, and that's the necessary step for Section 11 CAB of the legislation to for the terms of the conditions to be changed, so that part of the legislation is then complied with, and then because there is a lack of clarity about the definition of an instrument, whether it's a financial or capital instrument, therefore APRA would have enough legal wiggle room to implement. So I think that's important, that the banks are effectively saying that legally there is a pathway forward. Now the question is about And so obviously now we've got a question about intent. So I guess one question on this question is, so when they say they think it's a cock-up, well, I mean, given that we've got Canada, US, European Union, New Zealand in particular have put deposits on the table, why would we be the odd man out in that international equation? So did you put that to them and say, well, if you think that deposits are not on the table, but all these other sort of governments around the world have put deposits on the table, why do you think that the Australia's intent would be different from the rest of the world?
Yeah. And there was a lack of clarity in their responses when I started going there, if I can be honest.
Yeah. Right?
And I think, you know, if you understand that there is obviously a relationship between the banks and APRA, right, because yeah. they sort of you know, supervise the banks. My suspicion is that they're perhaps taking the weaker route, which is it's probably cock-up.
Yes. Right?
Rather than actually saying, oh, this is definitely a conspiracy. And in fact, I would have been very surprised if any of the banks had come out and said, no, we actually think it's deliberate.
Yes.
That's just my, you know, my personal opinion.
Yep.
So I think that that's about as far as that line of argument will go, but it does put the acid back on APRA, it seems to me.
Yep.
So my next step now is to write formally to APRA and basically document some of the discussions that I've had without mentioning names. And basically I'm now going to try and put the challenge back to them to say, right, now will you please clarify the situation? So that's my next step.
They'll be interesting to see what they say.
Yep.
Because I suspect what APRA is going to say is, well, we're going to follow the law. And it's up to Parliament to define what the... Because you're asking what the parameters are. APRA is probably going to say, well, Parliament defines the parameters, not us. And we're just going to follow the law. And they'll probably they'll give you a non-response, which is the typical APRA sort of play. And then you go to Parliament and Parliament says, well, this is not even an issue. So there's no need to even ask the question.
Yeah, well, we'll see. So my next call, as I say, is APRA.
Okay.
So that's my sort of plan for the next couple of weeks. And we'll see. It'll take time, I'm sure. But they won't respond quickly is normal, you know, but that's fine. So, but that's what I'm going to do because it seems to me that there is some definitive clarity required.
Yes.
And I have a number of banks saying anything that we can do to help put pressure on APRA to try and get clarity would be appreciated.
Yes. Yes. Although the important thing is, in terms of the bail-in question, the interest for bail-in is not the banks, it is the government. Because the bail-in, as we've discussed in part one of our sort of, this is now the part four, but part one we said that the intent of bail-in is to limit the financial exposure of the taxpayer to a potential bailout, because it's either depression or bailout. And we're going to talk about the Royal Bank of Scotland soon, about what that actually costs the UK government and the whole British banking system and the GFC. So to prevent that massive public cost on the taxpayer, bail-in is this new weapon that's been brought in. And so if there's an intent to bail-in, now, the banks may not be sort of let in on the secret yet, if there is a secret. But even if the banks say we don't want bail-in, well, the government wants bail-in because this is ultimately a protection of the government's balance sheet.
I agree with that. But the banks also have an obligation with regard to their customers, right? And so the more customers that write to the bank and say, oi, what's really going on with deposit bail-in, the more that the banks are going to be actually forced to take a position.
The position will be is, according to the current law, our terms and conditions, it's not it is not on the table. But we've shown that it can quickly be put on the table with a couple of tweaks here and there.
Yeah, no, I agree. So, but I think you're right. Ultimately, we have to come back to the government.
Yes.
Right? Because ultimately, there is legislation that was passed in Parliament.
That's right.
Right?
Yep.
And we already know that there are some... statements that are, you know, we'll perhaps cover in a second, which suggest that in fact the government is taking a rather different path as to what the situation is. So perhaps that's where we go next, maybe.
Sure. So yes, so we did have one government MP, Ted O'Brien, the member for Fairfax, responding to a DFA viewer who wrote to his local member to ask about, you know, in response to our three-part series, and said, well, what is the intent of the government on this question? And we have a very definitive statement from the member for Fairfax, and Mr. O'Brien says, the legislation which was passed recently does not implement any sort of bank bailing policy that would allow the seizure of deposits in times of financial instability. The government has no intention of implementing such a policy. Depositors' claims are explicitly protected by the Banking Act 1959. In the unlikely event of a bank failure, Australian depositors have priority claim on the assets of a failed authorised deposit-taking institution ahead of other unsecured creditors. We have a Member of Parliament saying the legislation does not do it. Now, we have shown that it does do it, or it has the possibility of doing it, and we have shown that Members of Parliament or advisers misread the legislation and they didn't consider the full context of how this legislation interacts with the terms and conditions of bank deposit accounts, terms and conditions, and therefore any categorical statement from a politician who hasn't investigated this thoroughly, I think, is a deficient statement. Whether this parliamentarian actually is aware of the situation and is seeking to mislead, I mean, I think it's premature to be that categorical. But you know, there's a whole host of politicians who, and separate from this member, there are other members of parliament who watched our three-part series and now are questioning about what's really going on. So there are other people within the government who now accept our version of events and that there is a possibility to bail in if these terms and conditions are changed, and they are wondering, well, you know, what is the intent of APRA? What's the intent of Morrison? What's the intent of the RBA, etc.? A backbencher hardly ever knows what the cabinet is really up to, or a particular minister like the treasurer. So this could be a very closed door conversation between the treasurer, the head of APRA, maybe some officials in Treasury, and it was pushed through stealth, very hush hush, and most members of Parliament didn't even know that the legislation was in the chamber and was being passed. So you know, again, when this person says the government has no intention, there may be an intention, but backbenchers may not have actually access to that information, which I think for most people they find surprising. But yeah, I mean, ministers tend to be quite secretive about what's happening within cabinet, what's happening within their respective portfolios that backbenchers generally don't have access to. Most backbenchers, people think that members of parliament are informed. Having worked for a backbencher initially in opposition, most of the information that a backbencher gets is actually through the media, you know, rather than through internal communication channels.
Okay, it's very interesting. And let me give you another perspective here as well, because there's a question about the Banking Act, right? But if you actually look at it carefully, my read of it is that deposits are essentially unsecured loans by individuals to the bank.
Yes.
Right? So a lot of people will say, but when I hand money over to the bank, aren't I actually, you know, aren't they looking after it for me? So my money is at the bank.
Yeah.
That's what most people would think deposits were.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, the formal definition is it's an unsecured loan to the bank.
Yes.
Right? They can then do it with what they will and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But as an unsecured loan, right, that means you come behind a whole lot of other secured creditors.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So, in fact, I don't think that depositors and deposits necessarily take a priority position. That's my reading anyway of the Act. Could be wrong, but that's I'm not a lawyer, but that's what I believe to be.
Yes, and on that point, I mean, am I correct in saying it was the Financial Stability Board or was it the BIS who in the last decade have tried to emphasise that point more strongly, that when a individual gives money to a bank as a deposit, the individual is loaning the money to the bank?
Yeah, so it's the FSB and the BIS, both in different contexts.
Yeah.
Been emphasising that because it's part of the infrastructure of bail-in.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yep.
So basically they've changed the concept on its head in order to justify the bail-in concept.
Yeah, whether they've changed it or whether it was always the case, I think is a bit of a moot point. It was never really very clear until quite recently, but all of the recent thinking that's been done by those global regulators seem to make it clearer and clearer and clearer that it is an unsecured loan.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why it can be used in the context of bail-in. And that's why depositors don't necessarily have any primary protection. Yeah. And by the way, I should have mentioned earlier on, a lot of the responses from the politicians and even from some of the banks conflated the bail-in and the 250k protection.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And it seems to me that they've lost the plot because, of course, they're not the same.
They are not the same.
Right?
They are not.
So a bail-in is done effectively at the end of the process, right? Whereas the deposit protection is done completely when the banks fall over.
Precisely.
Right?
Precisely.
So a bail-in is trying to actually keep the bank going.
Yep.
It's on life support.
That's right.
So we'll put more money in and we'll keep the thing going so the bank doesn't fall over. And because the bank hasn't fallen over, the 250k deposit protection doesn't apply.
Precisely.
Right?
Yep.
The 250k deposit protection only applies in a gone situation. In other words, when the bank has fallen over completely.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And yet a lot of the stuff that came back and a lot of the stuff that I got from the various followers on YouTube were conflating the two things, right?
Exactly. Yep.
So it's really important people get that there are two different stories here. The 250k deposit is nothing to do with deposit bailing.
Precisely. So just to surmise, if a watcher of this program has a deposit, they either knowingly or unknowingly have given the bank a loan. The bank is paying them a rate of interest. Now,
derisory rate of interest on an unsecured basis, I might add.
Yes. So the individual, the viewer, has given the bank an unsecured loan.
Yep.
If it's a term deposit, you're getting, you know, something half decent at 2.5% to maybe 2.2%. But if it's just an everyday sort of user account where you're getting, you know, basically bugger all, I mean, you're basically giving the bank your money as a loan for free. And you have basically signed on to doing that by signing the terms and conditions of the deposit account. And because you have given a loan, you are an unsecured creditor. Some banks have legally now conceded that there is a legal pathway to bail-in because of what we have shown throughout this particular series of programs, and that they are not sure about what is the intent of the government behind this. So basically what we're saying to the viewers is, if you have significant sums of money in the bank and you are concerned about the safety of it, well, we have some clarity as to, it is, you know, the money, you know, the money is at risk. If we have a systemic crisis, if one of these banks are in serious trouble, but the question is, will APRA, will the government under certain conditions bail in or not?
Yep, absolutely. And that's, of course, the open question.
Indeed. Yep. Now, on this question of intent, there was one viewer who got a very interesting response from the Special Minister for State, Mr. Alex Hawke. Now, Mr. Hawke is not in the Treasury portfolio, in his current portfolio as the Special Minister for State. So we're going to read a quote coming from his office. Now, the way this happens is, if you get a letter from a constituent, and it's not related to your portfolio, you go to the relevant minister or their office and say, I've just got this inquiry from a constituent. Do I have a set of words that you and your department are comfortable with for me to respond to? So this language that we're going to quote now, yes, it's come from Minister Hawke's office, but it has been drafted not by him or his department, which is the finance department that looks after the Special Minister of State responsibilities, but it would have been either the Treasurer's office or the Treasury. Now, that's what we don't know, where this language came from, but the language is very significant in my view, because it's effectively saying something unique in the international conversation that I don't think any other government around the world is saying. So we had this correspondence from Mr. Hawke on the 24th of October, 2018, and the sentence goes, as certain examples from the global financial crisis demonstrated, retaining the confidence of retail depositors in a crisis is crucial to minimizing wider contagion effects across the banking system. Where attempts were made to impose losses on depositors, such as in the case of Cyprus, this led to severe contagion impacts which effectively undermined the whole financial system. So this is significant because this is basically saying bail-in will actually cause contagion. So you know, if you want to limit the amount of financial panic and risk spreading out throughout the system, bail-in is the last thing you're going to do. And yet the whole world, and particularly in the case of Cyprus, no, bail-in is what you do to stop contagion from occurring if you do not want to impose that cost on the government or on the taxpayer. So now, having said that, I think there's two things to say here. We're talking about the immediate crisis here. In the immediate moment where you have to save the bank, you bail in to stop the crisis from spreading. Once you bail in like you did in Cyprus, I mean, that will have second and third round impacts over subsequent years of undermining confidence in the banking system. But what this statement is saying is a very unique proposition coming from the Australian government. And there is no government around the world that is basically saying, if you bail in, you're going to make the problem even worse. No, everyone's saying, well, we need to bail in to stop the problem from getting out of control.
And just to be clear, the Financial Stability Board, which basically cooked this up in the first place, right?
Yeah.
The Bank for International Settlement and other global regulators, as well as entities in a number of other countries around the world, are all now positioned as with bail-in as effectively the best solution to stop a bailout happening.
Yep.
And to stop damage to the broader taxpayer and broader budgets.
Right? Yes. Yes.
That's the whole philosophy.
Yes.
And yet this statement is effectively turning it back on its head again.
Yes.
Which is remarkable.
I mean, to be honest, I mean, I would be shocked if the Treasurer's Office drafted this sentence without any formal checking by the department. So assuming that the Treasury has basically effectively signed off on this sentence, what does this say about bureaucrats and their understanding of financial crises and the banking system?
And I think it goes back to the point we made in the earlier discussion, that was that, you know, is the level of knowledge to the point where, in fact, people really don't know what they're doing, right? Because this is a really serious situation that we're touching on here, a serious set of circumstances, and frankly, people perhaps have just not thought through all of the implications of what these things could be.
Sure, yeah. So on the surface, we can't really assess what the real state of knowledge is. All we can look at is the murkiness of the law. We can see a pathway towards bail-in. We can see from historical experience of where a government would be enticed to bring bail-in in, you know, look to actually enact it. And yet the reassurances or the responses from the people in power, you know, it's just not sort of, you know, giving me any confidence that either they fully understand the law, they fully understand how the future crisis that you and I have been talking about will play out, but also what are the options that government will have at that moment, and whether at that moment will a government actually say, well, we have to do it because we have no other choice. So where I think would be useful to take the conversation here is to go and have a look at what happened with the Royal Bank of Scotland. So there was a recent BBC documentary that goes for about an hour, which was sort of aired on British TV this year. They talked about how the Royal Bank of Scotland nearly collapsed in the GFC and what was the backstory behind it. So there's a couple of angles to look at this. So we've got a few clips that we'll play for the viewers. So the first thing is obviously talking about the bureaucrats. So there was a very interesting clip of a journalist who reflected on who was to blame for the Royal Bank of Scotland fiasco. And there was a lot of heat at the time placed on the RBS CEO. But this journalist was actually saying no. There was a whole host of other people at fault, from the board of the RBS to the regulator, which would be the APRA equivalent to the government itself.
But a lot of other people deserve a share of the blame too. The RBS board didn't do its job properly. The regulators paid insufficient attention. The government was high on tax receipts from these booming banks and didn't ask the right questions about what was really going on.
Yes, very interesting. And of course, just to be clear, the Royal Bank of Scotland was in a huge growth mode.
Yes.
Right, in the early 2000s, right? It basically acquired lots of businesses around the world. And for a long period of time, the banking industry, the investors, and the government all thought that they were magicians.
Yes.
They thought they got this wonderful mix, this ability to create, larger and larger. And they got into the top five globally of banks through doing it, right? But in doing so, they laid the seeds for their own destruction. But in the meantime, they paid massive amounts of tax to the Treasury in the UK, right?
Yes.
And huge numbers of other investors around the world make massive amounts of money out of the Royal Bank of Scotland.
Absolutely, absolutely. So basically from here, what is important to note for the viewers is when the Royal Bank of Scotland got into trouble, there was not a bail-in, it was a bail-out. Now, we have a clip we're going to play that talks about, so I think the direct bailout cost for RBS was in the order of £45 billion, but the total cost to the system was in excess of £1 trillion. So how about we play that clip for the viewers?
Government has now begun to sell its shares in the bank, slowly returning it to private ownership. It's unlikely, however, that we will recoup all of the £45 billion invested in RBS. In all, the government bailout of the banking system cost the British taxpayer well over £1 trillion. The economy has yet to fully recover, and Britain has endured one of the most turbulent political decades in living memory.
And that's remarkable, right? Just the quantum of money we're talking about here.
Yes.
It is huge.
Yes, yes. And so the interesting thing there was that the government, the UK government, stepped in and started buying the shares of the banks to basically nationalise it. Now, the thing is, when I've spoken to certain people in Parliament and we've gone through these scenarios of what will the government do in a crisis, certain people have said depression is inconceivable, so we won't even contemplate allowing the banks to fail. Certain people have said that bail-in, for them personally, even though the law says differently, bail-in would be politically unacceptable. And even macro business. After, I think, one of our previous shows, they put the link up on macro business and said bail-in is completely impossible because of the political consequences if they were to bail-in. So this advisor who I spoke to previously said, well, given that depression's off the table, bail-in's politically impossible, it must be nationalisation. Now, so obviously the British did nationalisation, and it cost them $1 trillion. And obviously now, according to the documentary, the government is starting to contemplate selling those RBS shares back onto the private market, but they are not going to make up the money that they put up initially. So if you are the treasurer, if you're the prime minister, if you're a bean counter in the bureaucracy, and you're going to say, well, how do we stop a depression, but how do we not impair the government's balance sheet to an extent that we're going to have massive long-term issues. But if we had to cop $500 billion to $1 trillion of additional government debt to keep the system going, well, that's going to linger for maybe 2, 3, 4 decades. And there'll be a question as to whether the government would even have the ability to repay that level of money, over the next 2 or 3 decades. So that is a real cost to government, both in the short term but also in the long term. So this clip I think is significant because when people say, well, why would a government bail in, it is precisely the cost that the British have taken on their balance sheet of $1 trillion. People say, well, if we're going to stop a depression and we can't accept this cost to the taxpayer, what's the other option? It is to say to the depositors, who, which we just said before, they have given a loan to the bank. Well, you've given the loan to the bank. Well, surely you knew if you gave the loan to the bank what you were doing. Therefore, you're the party that's going to take the hit.
And just to be clear, the reason that effectively they bought the shares at the Royal Bank of Scotland was because they believed that in a few days the bank would fail. And the contagion that would be created from that, not just in the UK, but around the world, would have actually brought the financial system to a halt. Right?
Yep.
So effectively, in a very short period of time, they worked this approach out, and they basically said, you know, it's a one-shot opportunity.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And they did it to save the financial system.
Yep.
At the cost of the taxpayer.
Yes.
And the taxpayer is still paying today, a decade later.
Indeed. Indeed. So there's a few other clips that I think from the documentary that are important. So there's a few moments as I watched it last week that really caught my eye that I thought to myself, well, if someone wants to understand how a bail-in could actually come into effect, there's a few moments from this clip that I thought we should play to the viewers just so that they sort of get a sense as to how a financial crisis may play out. So there's an interesting clip of where the chairman of the Royal Bank of Scotland is in panic mode, basically demands to speak to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, which is the equivalent of our Treasurer, and basically says, our bank is in trouble, what are you going to do? So how about we play that one clip for the viewers now?
While Darling was in the meeting, his team received a call from London.
The chairman of RBS wanted to talk to Alistair directly, which is always a bad sign. When a bank chairman, you know, urgently wants to speak to the Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Sir Tom MacKillop had been chairman of RBS for less than 2 years. He'd come from the pharmaceutical industry, and this was his first experience of a banking crisis.
He was clearly very, very anxious and very agitated. And he said, look, we're hemorrhaging money. There's billions going out of the door. What are you going to do about it? And I said, well, how long can you last? And there was a pause, and I thought I heard him talk to somebody, and he said, well, we're going to run out of money this afternoon.
Wouldn't want to receive that phone call.
No. So the significance of that is that he calls up the Treasurer or the Chancellor of the Exchequer and basically says, we're running out of money. How long can you last this afternoon? So if one of the big four are in trouble, you know, it is quite conceivable that they may talk to the head of APRA, they may talk to the RBA governor, or they may talk to call the Treasurer in Canberra directly and saying, we've only got a few hours before the bank's about to fail. Now, we would hope that APRA has its sort of finger on the pulse much more closely, and so that, you know, there wouldn't be such a shock of a call, and they could foresee, you know, whether that sort of crisis is going to happen. But one of the big points is, and I don't think really no one has talked about it, is APRA is responsible for the Australian system. The Australian system is a node or a clog in a global system, and basically APRA, this one, doesn't have the mandate, but two, doesn't have the manpower or the resources. Because if you think of this from a systems engineering point of view, you have to understand the whole system and how that works and where the choke points are to understand how, if the system fails, how that may affect you. So if something blows up overseas, something could be coming, you know, via one of our banks that APRA hasn't thought through properly, or is not on their radar. And then it could well be that the head of the chair of one of the big four calls the Treasurer up and says, we got 6 hours before the bank is going to fail. So that was what I would call stage one of looking at the RBS case study, how this may play out in Australia. And then obviously, in terms of stage two, what happened with RBS was the Bank of England tried to step in by providing a massive amount of liquidity to basically keep the bank afloat. So how about we play that clip?
We basically decided that we would have to extend whatever cash RBS needed to get through that day, but to get through the next few weeks. We had no choice. The banking system as a whole was going to collapse.
Mervyn King asked Andrew Bailey, a senior official at the Bank of England, to meet John Cummings, the chief financial officer of RBS, to discuss how much the bank needed to stay afloat.
I know John quite well. He was quite stressed, obviously, and this was an unprecedented situation. So we talked about broad numbers. I think John talked about a number up to about £25 billion at that time, and that could be needed very quickly.
The Bank of England suspected that RBS would need much more liquidity than they were asking for, but lending vast sums of public money to the struggling bank created a new risk.
If we had simply said, well, today we are lending Royal Bank of Scotland £30 or £40 billion, I was worried that we would simply trigger a run on the bank. So I was determined that we would have to do this covertly.
The Bank of England secretly transferred government bonds to RBS, which you could then swap in the markets for cash.
It worked very successfully, and the operations did solve their immediate liquidity problems.
Total lending facility to RBS reached its highest level at just over £36 billion. It was a very big intervention. I think it's one of the biggest interventions ever done anywhere.
But the billions lent to RBS by the Bank of England was only the first step.
And so the point about that was it had to be done really quickly.
Yes.
And it had to be done covertly.
First point is that Bank of England intervened and it wasn't enough. So that's why they had the bailout. Now, we've talked about in the previously that when you look at the bank capital structure in Australia, is you've got the reserves, you've got the hybrid securities, which everyone admits that that can be bailed in, and you've got the committed liquidity facility, the CLF, which is about $250 billion. Now, if the RBA was to intervene, that's the mechanism in which you would intervene using the CLF. Now, if the CLF, if they go through that, if they go through the hybrid securities, if they go through the bank the bank reserves, and that's still not enough, well, then something else has to happen. But the other significant point about this clip is precisely what you said, is the Bank of England worked covertly. And they think it's legitimate to work in secret, because if you're transparent in the heat of the crisis, you're just going to inflame fear and you're going to inflame panic. So people may think that they've got the money in the bank, and then if a crisis were to occur, they have time to pull it out. And even my own family members, I've got, a sister who has significant sums in one of the big four. And we've talked about, for example, I was at her place a few months ago on a Friday night, and I said, what if the European markets open tonight and Deutsche Bank declares insolvency? By tomorrow morning, as in Saturday, the capital controls may be already in place and you may not be able to get your money, particularly given that it's a weekend. And there was this sort of fanciful response from my sister in terms of, well, she lives in Woolite Creek. She goes, the Rockdale branch of one of the big four is open. I'll get there first thing in the morning, and I'll try to take as much money as I want. So, in normal conditions, if you're going to take tens of thousands of dollars out of a bank, you've got to give the bank forewarning so they can organize that amount of money on site. So you can't just rock up to a bank and saying, hey, I want, $50,000 or $80,000, whatever the case may be, and they're just going to give to you, because some of these branches may only have about $50,000 in cash on site. So I basically go through this explanation, and then she goes, well, if I can't get all my money out of Rockdale, I'm going to hop in the car and then drive out to Campbelltown, and Campbelltown should have the rest. I said, by the time you get to Campbelltown, from moving from Rockdale to Campbelltown, by the time you get there, there'll be a long line of people trying to get their money, and it's going to be too late. It could well be that if a crisis happens, things happen without you knowing, and then when you do finally realize that something is happening, it is too late to act.
Mm. And, very, very small example, but the FPOS system fell over for 2 days, Friday and Saturday, for many people, right? And the fact that those systems stopped for a brief period of time has created whole lots of issues for people trying to get money out from ATMs, trying to make payments, right? And that's just a small technical problem.
Yes.
So multiply that by the size of a major financial crisis and you can see the problem. And the other thing that's worth noting is that if you look at Northern Rock and also Royal Bank of Scotland, their internet banking systems also collapsed.
Well, was it intentional or was it by accident?
That's a very good question. Was it lots of people trying to move money around, or was it actually turned off? We don't know. But basically, the physical cash, as you say, is hard to get, and the electronic systems may well not be there.
Yes, yes.
And we're talking not, weeks for this to all happen. This could happen very quickly, and that's the point.
So it could happen within hours. Yeah. So before a bail-in, and I think we said this in a previous episode, before a bail-in would actually happen, the first thing a bank has to do is implement capital controls. So it's got to stop the bleeding and basically stop money getting out the door. And then they have to assess as to, well, what is our financial position? Can we survive if we can't? And we've already burned through the existing capital structures, and the Reserve Bank or the Bank of England can't give us anything more. Well, then we have to go to government so that we can get that additional amount of capital, so we can stay afloat. So we basically have a clip now from the former Chancellor of the Exchequer that was under the Brown government that basically talked about this engineering of the bailout. And the famous sort of, or the most prominent sort of statement from this is, we have only one shot. So how about we play that for the viewers?
What we needed to do was first and foremost make sure that banks had adequate capital, that's money behind them that they could draw on, so they could carry on functioning, but also critically give markets and investors confidence that they had something to fall back on.
The sheer scale and speed of the government bailout plan was unprecedented.
This is not an off-the-shelf scheme. This is something that was radical. It could absolutely have erupted if people had responded badly.
We only had one shot here. If the plan worked, it would be fine. If it didn't work, there was nothing else we could have done. And you do not get two shots at these things.
And again, the whole point there was they were working overnight.
Yes.
They had a limited window. They knew that by the following morning they needed a solution.
Yes.
Or it would all blow up in their face.
Exactly. If a politician is on the hot seat and they only have one shot to save the system. In the Bank of England's in the Royal Bank of Scotland situation, bail-in wasn't an option. But if the advice coming to Treasury says you've got one shot to save the economy. It's either bail out and basically, have this red ink across the government's balance sheet for the next 30 years, or you institute a bail-in and certain depositors will take a hit. Well, it is conceivable that under certain conditions, certain politicians will say, that's the least worst option, bail-in, so let's flick the switch. And we obviously do it. And so I'm not sure if it was played in these clips, but some of these communications between the bank and the Chancellor of the Exchequer happened at 5 a.m. So while everyone is sleeping, politicians and banks will be on the phone trying to negotiate these things. And by the time you wake up in the morning, a bail-in could happen. So this is something that we said in a previous episode that, according to the terms and conditions of these deposit accounts, they have to give, they don't have to give the customer notice, but they have said they'll put some sort of announcement in a major newspaper. They could change the terms and conditions in the middle of the night. There could be an agreement with APRA and the government to bail in. And by the time you wake up, by the time there's a notice in the newspaper, it could all be done and dusted. And that it was obviously a key sort of takeaway lesson from this documentary in terms of when did the government actually speak to the banks. But also, when you look at superannuation, and obviously a lot of people in Australia with superannuation have a lot of their money in bank shares. Well, when this crisis fully played out with the Royal Bank of Scotland, their shares fell 90%. So, and 90% within a few hours. If the banks get into trouble and you're holding the shares or the stock of a bank or a company, you could lose enormous amounts of wealth very, very quickly. And obviously, if the bank can be saved, well, maybe the stock price will recover somewhat. It won't be back to its highs, but you may recover some wealth. But if they can't save the patient, well, then you've lost your entire investment, whatever that is in the bank.
Yeah, and that just shows you how high the stakes are here, right?
Yeah.
With large, complex financial organisations that are connected globally with entities around the world that are reliant on international financing,
yes,
right, that are overlent, right, that are not that well regulated, right, and now with the bail-in formulation at least somewhat on the table.
Yep.
And that, I think, sums up where we are.
Yes. So basically, in order to sum up the full conversation, is it is legal. We've shown it. Some banks say that it's murky and unclear. No one knows the intent of the government, but we've shown through the Royal Bank of Scotland, the intent could well be what the former RBA governor said in 2015 is, it is to limit the exposure of the taxpayer.
Yep. And if that is the real agenda, then I think there should be more clarity here in Australia.
Well, but the question is, can they? Because if they were, a serious point here, if they were transparent, what would that do to confidence among depositors? It's interesting because we've got some feedback from people in New Zealand to say, even though the government is transparent in New Zealand, most people in New Zealand don't actually fully comprehend what the government is actually saying. Now, if the Prime Minister came out tomorrow and said, okay, the game's up, Adams and North have sort of exposed us, we're going to admit that our real intent is to, under the most extremist of extreme circumstances, to bail in, to stop government debt getting out of control, and we're going to be transparent, but we think the probability of that sort of event is very, very small. How many people will keep significant sums of money in the bank with a public disclosure from the PM?
Right, but if on the other hand they pass an amendment to the Act that clearly excludes deposits, right, which they could do, then effectively that would actually tidy everything up very nicely.
Sure, sure. That is if they have cocked up. But if it is the conspiracy, my question is, if they are transparent, surely that will actually lead to significant sums of money being run out of the banks, and that's what they don't want. So therefore, they can't be transparent.
Yeah. Okay. And which goes back to, is it cock up or is it conspiracy, right? And if, as we said earlier on, and as many of the banks think it was actually a cock up, then the simplest way to solve it is simply to pass an amendment to exclude deposits expressly from it.
Right? Yes. Yes.
If that's not done, then we have to conclude that there's a reason why they haven't done it.
Yes, yes.
Which is exactly what you're saying.
Thing is, having a Middle Eastern background, when I was growing up, there's a famous saying in the Middle East is, a lack of a response is a response within itself.
Yes.
So if we get no response from the government, from APRA, we know that what the real response is.
Yep. So even silence actually speaks a loud volume.
Absolutely.
John, thank you very much. Very interesting conversation. I suspect we'll be revisiting this a little later.
Yes, indeed.
Thanks for your time. So there you have it. More on bail-in. I'm sorry it's not clear, but we'll continue to press and see whether we can drive the conversation further forward. If you found this useful, please like and share the post, add a comment or a question. And check back next time for our next episode. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Thanks for watching.